Hey there team, welcome to an episode of the Women of Words podcast. Today, we're lucky enough to chat with Australian singer-songwriter Eve Skouridis. We hope you enjoy this conversation.
I tried to be funny and Michael was sort of shutting me down just before. I thought it would be funny to throw a random fact about your birthday in there.
Oh, I did see that. Funny, I kind of was like, when I was reading it, I was really busy and I was like, what's the relevance of this?
Yeah, trust me, I've already copped it from Michael, so I won't touch on that one. Try to break the ice a little bit.
I thought it was something on your behalf. I'm like, oh, is she like a massive fan of this figure skater that Liam's talking about? I'm like, that's cool.
It's just funny because there's like other things that happened on my birthday that are more notable.
So, Murph, you went like to the 11th or the 12th on the list for that.
Hey, Maya Shibutani is an Olympic bronze medalist, so it's pretty big.
I mean, hey, look, more bronze medals than I have, I guess. But, shout out to her. Hannah, I'm actually haven't yet told Liam this for our conversation today, but I'm actually kind of looking to broach away from the topic of mental health and just talk about Ableton for the next 45 minutes because I am Liam and I at this point are both Ableton tragics. We've been using it for a little while and having a bit of a muck around with it. And I found out in doing a little bit of research that's your foray, that you've got a bit of skill in that department, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, I mean, full disclosure, I haven't used Ableton in maybe two years. I switched to Logic just because I'd been using Ableton for so long, and then I don't actually like Logic. So I will go back to Ableton.
I think it's I think it might be an interesting place to start, Hannah, because there's, I guess for a lot of musicians, there's this huge skill set that people have on the production side of things as opposed to your the singer and songwriter thing. And I guess a lot of people see a line sort of drawn between those two some of the time. But I'm curious as to what you were sort of drawn to, or what made you want to dive into the production side of things and where that sort of interest came from.
Honestly, and I hate admitting this, it came from one of my boyfriends in the past.
Right. Okay.
He once said to me, it was good. It was like a really positive kind of pep talk. I was just getting really frustrated. Like when I was younger, just being kind of at the mercy of producers and people not understanding how I wanted to sound. And he was just like, you just need to take back control. And he gave me like a free copy of Ableton off of his subscription or whatever you'd call it. And then I used that for years, even after we'd broken up.
Nice. Love that.
It was this, I think, urge and need for me to just take back control, because where else am I going to find that other than through my own work and my own fingers? And it was really empowering, because within like a couple of months of diving into Ableton, I kind of came up with Further Than the Planes Fly, which is one of my most successful songs. It just unlocked such a creative part of my brain that I think I was really needing to do. And I love being able to put my hand in production. I'm not amazing at it. I think because I've always just been too obsessed with writing lyrics and melodies, but it's good to have the skill, even just to press record and get your ideas down. And it's a good bouncing board. Like you take something into a studio that you've already started and it's like, it's already got my DNA in it, so.
Yeah, 100%. No, I like that. I think it is, we were lucky enough, we chat to the guys from Holy Holy just a little while ago, and I remember, so Tim, who obviously they write a lot of their stuff together, but Tim as a songwriter and, he sort of, his process was just, working songs out on guitar and writing a lot of the lyrics for those guys. And he talked about, when he paired up with Oscar, who obviously has a world of production knowledge and skill at his fingertips, he was like, he's like, my songwriting just like went into a different universe, because all of a sudden, instead of me just writing, you know, on like a four chord progression on a guitar, here I am, I've got every known sound in the bloody universe at my disposal with somebody who kind of, you know, knows how to pull it all together, which, so yeah, I guess, I can see the, I can see how it feels.
Well, that's the magic of collaboration. And that's why I love collaborating so much. I like started making music on my own, but I think I truly fell in love with, I fell in love with music when I was a kid, but my job and the way that I operate and make records, like I love that that is through collaboration, because I just, I'm like, ooh. Creativity with one person, awesome. Creativity in two people, put them together, it's like an infinite universe. So yeah, I think it's really cool. I love the Holy Holy guys. I used to kind of like years and years ago be in the same circles with them. I think they were in Brisbane. Yeah, ages ago, before they both moved to Melbourne. So yeah, they're really nice.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, no, very, legends. Very nice. Absolute gentlemen, those fellas. I just on that, and yeah, like we have so much stuff that we want to talk about, but I'm just curious about this space a little bit, because you talk about that, like that control of you know that you were given, or that empowerment that you got from having the skill set to be able to like take what you're hearing in your head and really sort of put that out, you know, make a tangible version of it through your production sort of skill. Is that, did you ever have to learn, or was it a bit of a, was there any sort of learning curve with balancing that control when you fell in love with the collaboration side of things as well? Like, was there ever, because they seem juxtaposed in a way, I guess.
Yeah. I battle with that every day. Okay. But I will say, when you find your people, that's when the magic happens. I think like I've spent so many months and years like being put into sessions with complete randoms all over the world, like LA, London, Stockholm, New York. And it's like one in 50 work, you know, it's like really hard to find that chemistry. But when you do, it's the best thing in the world.
Yeah, okay. So that's it. I mean, that's the reward for the like, for the compromise or whatever you want to call it. But
yeah, you got to dig to get the gold.
Yes.
Cliches.
You'll find out pretty quick that we love the cliches on this chat. Anna?
Particularly Michael, he's the cliche king.
I don't even mean it. I swear to God, I don't mean it. And my life is just a walking cliche, obviously.
Hannah, I want to, like, on that, you mentioned, like, you know, one in 50 is, you know, at a random number, that, but, you know, you feel like that. Do you find that whole process frustrating, or do you kind of, you know, it is what it is, and you know that, you know, not everyone's going to work, so just keep going?
I don't want to say it's a struggle, because it's not a struggle compared to some jobs that people have, but because so much of yourself is tied up in creativity, it can be really confusing when you're put in a room where you just don't mesh with someone, and it's like all your ideas and even your personality just feels wrong. So it can be pretty conflicting. It is tough. It's really hard to keep the stamina and to remind yourself of those really good moments. But I don't know. I think it's the love of doing it that keeps me going. I know it's like, yeah, it's not a job for everyone, what I do. And there's definitely people with more stamina than me.
No, that's good. I want to talk, you mentioned you fell in love with music as a kid, and you mentioned the love of music is what keeps you going. So maybe that's a good way to I guess, go back to the origins of Hannah and find your way to your stage name now, Aziz Caritas. So, yeah, love to know what it was like and how music entered your life as a kid up in you know, Cairns growing up, or Brisbane? Yeah.
Cairns. Yeah, I think I was always drawn to music, but I have an older brother who got into guitar before I did, and I think it was just having guitars around the house that kind of made it seem normal. And I also started writing songs because I got bored of singing other people's songs when I was around 12. So, yeah, it was a couple of things. And then I started, you know, getting into artists like Joni Mitchell and Bruce Springsteen around that age, and was just so fascinated by the way they tell stories. And I just was like, I want to do that. So, yeah, I think it's having heroes, wanting to achieve great things, being overly ambitious, being an overachiever, which I definitely am. Yeah. But music's like something I've just never questioned, which kind of scares me now that I'm getting older. Like, I literally never stopped and thought, is this a good idea? Is this going to bring me happiness? Is this going to actually bring me success? I just did it. And it's weird because, I mean, we'll probably talk about this later, but yeah, this pandemic, having everything just sort of hit pause, has been the first time I've actually asked myself those questions, and it's been really confronting.
It's interesting. Yeah, I can imagine. And I mean, it's kind of, it's almost like the opposite situation, I guess, that a lot of people find themselves in, as opposed to where a lot of people will go through those formative years and into their 20s and 30s and sometimes maybe for their whole lives of not being sure, you know, of what they're doing and if it is the thing that, you know, that fulfills them and if it is the thing that is, you know, that big defining part of their life. So I can see the, like, the flip side of that as well, because, yeah, like you mentioned, it's, the last couple of years has been the most turbulent in our lifetimes, realistically. I want to ask quickly before we jump forward, you said Joni Mitchell, Bruce Springsteen, they seem like a bit of a generational jump from an older brother. Did you find that music just yourself, or was that a little bit of influence coming from elsewhere?
Through my dad, actually. Yeah, my dad's a huge Springsteen fan. I actually got into Joni Mitchell because I used to play and busk in cafes and stuff when I was around 13, 14, and people used to tell me, you should sing a Joni Mitchell song. And I didn't know who that was, so I looked it up one day. I think my dad might have had one of her records as well. But, it's just wild that I listened to that as a 14-year-old, because at the same time I was also listening to Hilary Duff and, like, Disney version of Miley Cyrus.
Hannah Montana as opposed to Wrecking Ball Miley Cyrus, right?
Yeah.
But I'm a primary school teacher, and I am secretly a fan of a lot of that music because I hear it every day anyway. So, I mean, you hear it, so you kind of get used to hearing it, I suppose. But, hey, yeah, stories are told in a lot of different ways, so it's cool to be able to, I guess, jump across a few genres and get some inspiration from left, right and centre. So all for it.
Yeah.
Hannah, I want to, as you know, we're super interested in sort of talking things all mental health challenges and you know, different ways that people have sort of dealt with things through their life. And I'm interested to hear about your time in London, because I know you made the move, I guess, at quite a young age to be shooting off overseas. And, I mean, you know, Liam and I, and I'm sure yourself as well, are huge advocates for travel. We think it's, you know, it's such a independence building thing. It's such a great way to develop empathy and understanding and realize that there's a big old world out there around us. And yeah, we're always interested in people's stories of their travels. And
yeah, I think London was always a dream. It's sort of similar to music and not questioning music. I just always was like, I'm going to live in London one day. And I don't know why. And I still want to live in London. I didn't actually make the choice to move back. It just sort of happened because I had a whole heap of touring back here in Australia. And it was like opportunity after opportunity. And then my first album came out, and then I was doing promo for that. And then before I knew it, I had been home for like 8 months. And I had given up my lease because of that. And I was just like, maybe I'll just stay. It's kind of nice. being back here with my parents and my family. And then I got into a relationship and everything kind of just happened. But I would love to go back over there. London is just, there's just so much, sounds such like such a white girl, but there's just so much culture. And that's coming from, you know, someone who's already multicultural. Like I grew up in a Greek family in Australia. So I didn't have like the whitest of upbringings, but I don't know, London is just so energizing. And I found some really, really great friends and collaborators over there. So have you guys ever lived in London or spent much time there?
I've been there, yeah. Michael's been there as well. I think I spent like 3 weeks in total there, and similarly could have easily stayed for 3 years, I feel like. Yeah. It's just, it feels like a just comfortable straight up.
Mm.
I don't know, a lot of similarities to Melbourne in terms of like the hustle and bustle of the city and suburbs. And, you know, like I did the 4 month stint in Europe and, you know, met some great people that were living in London and was able to go and hang out and stay a few nights at their places. And, you know, just everyone was so happy and welcoming. And I think just like the pub life, like the music life there, music scene's really, it was just fun.
Yeah.
I think I saw Ballpark Music in London for like £5 or something. Like it was brilliant. Wow. And it was just so like great. They just decided to play a show.
Yeah.
And they were just like, oh, yeah, well, let's just do it. We'll put £5 on the door. And it was just like a crowd of Aussies. It was unbelievable. But it was yeah, I love London.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, it's similar to Liam, like similar sort of experience. I only spent sort of short amount of time, a couple of times there. But my like only thing that I just couldn't work out is it didn't matter where I was staying, just like, you know, sleeping on friends' floors or whatever. Didn't matter what suburb it was, or like, you know, somebody would ask you where you're staying and I'm like, oh, at a friend's house in Clapham Common or wherever, and they'd be like, oh my god, there's just so many Aussies in that part of London. I'm like, I've heard that about every direction, north, east, south, west. It's like, oh, there's just so many Aussies out there.
Yeah,
like, well, maybe it's because it's awesome, like it's just a fun city. Like, do you ever think that's why?
People say that about Clapham, they say about Hackney, what's the suburb, Dalston, everywhere.
Yeah, now I just want to travel and I can't, so.
Oh, I know.
Yeah. Hannah, while you were over there, you got to support Dua Lipa. Was that why you were over in London? Like,
oh, no, I supported Dua 2018, or was that back over here? In Australia, yeah.
Okay, that was back here. So that's part of the reason you came back then?
Yeah, that was part of it. And I did Dua and then I did George Ezra. Initially, the first tour I did that I came back for was Cub Sport, which is funny because that's where I met my boyfriend because he's a drummer. And it's sort of just so strange how things work, because I just would never have thought that going back to Australia to do a tour that I was like, all right, get me back to London ASAP, would turn into my life now. But yeah, it's great. And then they're all like some of my best friends too, so.
I've only ever heard like super positive things come out of Cub Sport. Like, you know, you hear them on interviews on Triple J or whatever, and they just seem like the most grounded human beings.
Yeah, they are so lovely. They are like little angels that have fallen to earth.
And I tell you when I realized that, their Leica version, ultra light beam, just the like 7 minutes of harmonies, just stop. Oh my god, unreal.
Yeah,
which
tidy
little segue into Hannah. I have to say, like, diehard Aretha Franklin fan. That was like, you talk about your old man's influence, your old man Springsteen. Mm-hmm. Aretha was my mum's Springsteen. She like day and night just running records and yeah. Natural Woman, I mean.
Yeah.
Like, all time. That must have felt good.
That was a lot of pressure because I'd never done it before, and Triple J asked me to do that song.
Oh, wow, okay. Right. Just the greatest singer of all time, if you could just, yeah, do that one, thanks.
It was the week that she passed away, and they. Of course. I was planning on doing a Khalid song, which would have been great, but they put it to me. They're like, would you be up for covering this? And I was like, well, I also grew up listening to Carole King, who wrote that song, and that's honestly the only reason why I said yes to it, because I knew that, like, the back of my hand, that song, well, her version, Carole's version.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, I know I can do this. I feel like I have some similarities in my voice and my vocal style to Carole King. So I was like, all right, I can make this work. I'm not going to make a fool of myself. Yeah. So that was really special. I loved that, doing that.
That's awesome.
You're a bit of a Like a Virgin seasoned veteran now as well. You've done
two.
And the second one was Painkiller by Raw as well. So another young Aussie. That was one of my favourites as well. So
thanks, guys.
And I think Like a Virgin's so special. Probably you can fill us in a little bit more from your perspective. But as listeners, like, hearing your favourite artist cover another of your favourite artists in their own way adds that extra little dimension to it, I think. What's it? I mean, you sort of touched on it then with the timing as well of your first one and the pressures of it. But you mentioned earlier that you were sick of singing other people's songs, which is why you got into songwriting. And but then, like, you go back to fast forward to Like a Virgin's, where, you know, that's the whole point of it, I suppose, but to put your own spin on it. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, Like a Virgin, it's a tough one, because I think, you know, a lot of the music played on Triple J is indie, and it's really cool, for lack of a better word, when an indie artist covers like a pop song. But doing the reverse of that, like a pop artist covering an indie song, can be really scary, because indie music is revered and gatekept, and you know what I mean? And it's easier to cop some flack. So I think both times I didn't get to pick the first song, but the second time I was really like, oh my God, how do I do this? Last year was also a bit of a weird year with music. There wasn't a whole lot getting released, it felt like. But I mean, Painkiller is an awesome song, and although he's a pop artist, he was a guy, so I was like, all right, well, do the old gender flip and get away with this. I don't know, I think it's really cool. I personally like it because I get to work on the arrangement with a band, and going in there and performing it, like, it's fully live. Like, you kind of get only a couple takes and then that's it, and you just have to live with it. You don't get to hear it. It just, you hear it as it's on the radio, which is so scary. But my experiences have been really positive. It'd be awesome to do it again. I always like have random ideas for songs to do on it, but then I forget them every time. Like when I got asked to do it last year, I was like, damn it, where's that list of songs I had? And I just couldn't think of them.
So
that's great. I was going to ask that, like, is it something, I don't know, did you listen to Triple J growing up? Was that something you listened to?
I mean, in high school I did. Yeah, it was always on, like, at any sort of gathering or party. It's just what people listen to. So
yeah, for sure. It's interesting because, I mean, like, I similarly have been listening to Triple J since, I don't know, since the teen years, and Like a Virgin's always been one of my favourite bits of the week. So I always thought, like, as a kid, I was like, you know, if I become a famous musician in some alternate universe, I need to have a list just in case I get approached for Like a Virgin. So I'm interested to know, like, it's, and you mentioning that, you know, you hear songs or you think of ways that you might be able to, you know, arrange them differently, and you'd be like, oh, that'd be really cool if they came knocking again.
Yeah. I actually need to write them down.
I lost a bet with my, girlfriend then, but fiance now, that if I ever got to do a Like a Virgin on Triple J for some God unknown reason, that it had to be Kate Sobrano, Pash.
Do you know, I'm jumping on that. That's sick. I would love to hear you do that.
I would like to see that too. I'll second that.
Yeah, it's it. Just mixing it up, you know. Yeah, probably a nice time to maybe jump into some stuff along the mental health lines. I guess we're, as you know, as we said at the start of the chat, we're always interested in people's experiences, and I think regardless of how aware, you know, people have been and, you know, about mental health, it's something that affects us all, and it's something that is a part of everyone's life. I'm curious to know if it's, if like, you know, your own mental health and well-being is something that you've been aware of, considerate of through early stages of your life, in your teen years, through, you know, your career as well. I'm just curious as to when that sort of awareness kind of kicked in. Because I guess for a little context, you know, for myself, you know, we started this podcast a couple of years ago, and maybe a year preceding that was the first time that I'd ever considered it at all. And it was something that I just thought didn't exist and thought it was maybe a little bit, you know, not, you know, it was just kind of a bit of a faux problem and something that wasn't anything to do with me, you know. It was just seemed so foreign to me, obviously being 100% wrong, because that's not how life works. But yeah, it was very much a discovery for me. So I'm curious as to how that was for you.
I think I had some similarities in my journey. I kind of always pushed it aside, and I was always like, that's something that other people experience. Never really considered it, but looking back on my late teens and early 20s, like 100% was dealing with generalized anxiety disorder. Like, and I think I didn't quite become fully aware of it until, yeah, maybe 2 years ago. And that's when I was like, okay, something's up. I need to actually address this. Because I was just sort of spiraling. And I think I was my first sort of real taste of depression. It's like, it's hard to define a lot of the time. I started seeing a psychologist about a year and a half ago, which completely just changed my life, made me discover a lot of things about myself, probably the biggest of which is that I'm what they call a HSP, which is a highly sensitive person. It's actually like a condition.
Okay.
There's like, I have a book on it. It's kind of when you get very exhausted in social situations, you sort of tapped into smells, things you can see, things that like touch you, and then emotionally you're very, very in tune with like very small things about how you're feeling, and also you get very triggered very quickly, which is like all me. But it makes for good songwriting. Like, I know other people who are HSP who work in music, and yeah, it's definitely, it's like got its pros, but there's a lot of things about it that's just really tiring. And I'm just like, oh, I need to like go and take a nap after being around people for half an hour sometimes. But yeah, I think it's been really great just like going to see a psychologist that has just been so eye-opening, very helpful just talking things out. I think I used to have the wrong words, I think, and now I like learning about what's actually happening in my brain and why I think the way I do sometimes. So kind of learning more about the actual biology behind psychology is really interesting to me as well. And kind of gives me a sense of control over how I'm feeling. So I'm like, okay, well, this is happening for that reason. And there are actual strategies I can use to sort of, they talk a lot about like blood flow to the brain and different parts of your brain and how you are in your like fight or flight mode, or using your logical brain, or you're emotionally reacting. And all that sort of thing. I'm so talking out of my field right now. So if anyone's listening, they're just like, shut up.
Welcome to the Women of Words podcast. This is us talking out of our field as well. We love it. No, it's awesome.
Firstly, thank you for the insight and the openness with that answer. It's a, like Michael said, it's still a new thing for us. We're still learning as we go, and it's also something that we've become more aware of in terms of, like, we're still learning and, you know, speaking to all different people and hearing of their journeys and their challenges and, you know, their successes as well allows us to understand it at a greater level as well. The HSP is an interesting one. I want to touch on that in a second, but we are huge advocates of professional help and speaking up. And I think the first thing to do is congratulate you on, you know, taking the step to go and seek that help from a psychologist. And it's often the hardest part is that very first step and speaking up. And I'm interested to know if you're willing to speak on it and how you got to that first step.
Yeah, my boyfriend suggested it. And I think I was coming to that conclusion myself. I just noticed a lot of pattern behavior the year before, and I felt like I kept doing the same things over and over that, like, hurt me in an emotional way. And it was like very self-sabotaging sort of behavior, which just, I couldn't continue on the way I was going. And I also just wanted to have a healthy relationship with myself, which I hadn't had for a long time. So, and that's a work in progress, and it ebbs and flows. And I think it was really important for me going into seeing a psychologist, knowing that it wasn't going to be an instant fix. And I mean, even getting in to see a psychologist or a therapist or a psychiatrist, whatever it is you choose, is kind of laborious. And I can understand how people don't follow through with it, because at the moment, especially, like, waiting lists are so long to get in to see someone for the first time. And that person might not even be the right fit for you. And then you have to do that whole thing again. So it takes a lot, but obviously it's 100% worth the effort. And it's almost just a bit sad that it can be that hard. But I think a lot of people are going into the profession of psychology, which is good because people need it.
Yeah, 100%.
Absolutely. I think for me as well, like in the similar sort of vein to what you're saying, is that I found it exhausting as well to get to the psychologist the first time, because, you know, I had to open up to my then girlfriend, you know, now fiance, similar to Michael, same thing, but I'm still learning to say that, by the way.
But, we say that because we wish it was each other. I wish that Liam was my now fiance.
Oh, stop it.
I mean, we kind of are, we're pretty close enough, let's be honest.
I do love you, Michael. Everyone knows that. Yeah, but, like, you know, the first step for me, I had to build the courage up to tell my partner that I was really struggling, and then she suggested I speak to my family, so then I had to build the courage up to go and speak to my mum and dad, which was more scary to me than speaking to Amy first. And then after that, I was like, oh, fuck, now I have to build the courage to go and see my GP because I want to get a mental health plan.
Yep.
You've got to sit down in a room with the doctor in front of you. And they ask all these intimidating questions, and you sort of, you know, as I had pretty full on anxiety and I was having, you know, panic attacks at the time. So I was already closed up and claustrophobic as it was.
Yeah.
To then, you know, so that whole journey is, absolutely laborious. But I am lucky enough to say that actually it was my second, but the first psychologist I spoke to, I couldn't get onto for 4 months. So I got referred to another psychologist, and she was luckily, like, spot on perfect for me, and I got along with her really well straight away, and I was able to just go bang and just offload. And hearing all the not like labels, but the terms for what I was feeling. And, you know,
yeah,
she was able to say like, well, you know, bang, it's anxiety, it's severe anxiety, or, you know, that feeling you had was a panic attack.
Yeah.
It adds ease to the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm interested to know, that was really long-winded, I'm sorry, but when they first told you that you were HSP, highly sensitive person.
Highly sensitive person.
That, I like it. Did that come as a shock, or was it kind of just like a, oh, yeah, that makes sense, you know, I am really conscious of the people around me and I can smell things and, you know, I put a lot of effort into things. Like,
yeah. Oh, you know what? Someone else had mentioned HSP to me, which introduced what it meant before talking to my psych about it. And so I think she was just like confirming things I already knew. But my psychologist put me onto so much that has helped me, like from things like attachment theory, which was really important for me to understand, like for healthy relationships, like anxious attachment, avoidant attachment. I felt like a stereotype, like I bought a book about it and I was just like, oh my God. I was like, okay, so I'm doing all these things because of A, B, and C. It was really eye-opening, but yeah, I would pay. It's like priceless, that sort of insight and getting to learn these things about yourself. So yeah, I mean, like you said, it can be really confronting having to go through the process of getting into a psychologist, but so worth it.
It sounds like it sounds like through your experience you've gotten a lot of, not closure, but I guess you've taken a lot of solace and taken comfort in like understanding the things that are happening and like understanding the biochemistry and understanding the different, yeah, like you said, all these definitions and these things that sort of help you explain how you're feeling. Was there, through your experience, was there any like tangible things that you took away, i.e. like strategies, habits, like is there any of that sort of stuff, like healthy practices, healthy habits that you've sort of found either as a result of that work with your psychologist or just as a result of starting down that sort of starting down that mental health path?
Yeah, I think for me it's always about checking in with myself on a daily basis, because I tend to get swept up in my stress or swept up in my sort of depressive episodes. So it's almost like creating a buffer for those moments, and that's been really helpful. I don't know. It's interesting because I feel like a lot of the work I find with going to see someone happens outside of the session, because it's when you sort of put things together with like what you've talked about. And yeah, it's interesting. I actually, like, I have some strategies. Like they say, like when you get into those sort of heightened emotional response states to like have a drink of water or like say something silly out loud or something, and it almost just like hits a reboot or something on your brain.
Yeah
it's interesting.
Yeah, I like that. It's, you know, it's funny, and like, and this is a big part of why we love these conversations, is finding similarities with people's experiences that are just in totally different worlds. And, you know, you saying that right now reminds me of, you know, we had a conversation with the captain of the Bombers, Dyson Heppel, like 18 months ago, 2 years ago, Murph, ages ago, anyway, yeah, whenever it was. Yeah. And he talks about these anchors. And so, like, obviously in the version that he was talking about is in these heightened times of obviously, like, being in the middle of a football game, you know, getting tackled by sweaty dudes, he just had this thing that he would use. So if he got run to the bench, he used to have this old trainer that would come over with a towel with freezing cold water and would just put it around his neck. And he had basically anchored this like sense of calm or this state of calm to that feeling of the cold water, like running down his neck. And so he's like, the guy would come over, pull his towel on, and then boom, like I was zen, you know.
Yeah, nice.
And obviously not foolproof. I'm sure I didn't work every single time, but yeah, it's probably exactly the same thing as what you're talking about. And I just love that there's so many versions of it, I guess.
I find it interesting as well, and I don't know if this is just me thinking out loud or not, but a lot of the strategies that psychologists recommend, or, you know, you hear through other people, are really simple strategies. Mm. And I feel like when you're at that heightened thing, you're not thinking clearly, but the simplicity in just having a sip of water and, you know, slowing your body down to be able to swallow the sip of water, or, you know, breathing is the big one for me at the time. I was, when I got anxious, obviously my breathing changed, but, you know, the simplicity of going, okay, stop and just breathe in for 4 seconds.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, like really simple things, but they make a world of difference. And, you know, borderline instantly, similar to what Michael, what you were saying with Daiso in the cold tower, and like that quick switch to go, okay, it's all good.
Mm.
Just catch your breath. Like,
yeah,
simplicity. But do you, in terms of other strategies, in terms of, you know, say when you're in a really good headspace and try to maintain that headspace, do you read, or do you meditate or anything to try and stay on top of the goodness, I guess?
I've gotten into journaling, which is sort of a meditation practice for me, because it makes me stop and pause, and it's kind of like the act of just writing down your stream of consciousness without any judgment, without any reservation. And it's really interesting what happens when you do that, because you sort of do it when you first wake up, or in the morning when you've had a coffee or something, and you kind of start writing about things that you're observing. And then it slowly, you find it's like this almost like 2-page rule. Like, you get to halfway through the second page and you sort of just get to the core of what's actually like bothering you, or like what it is you need to address, like, or what you need to check in on with yourself. I just find it like kind of revolutionary, and it kind of like helps me get back in touch with a lot of my values and what I think is important, what I actually want to focus on in my day. I like to set intentions as well. It's funny because I don't really do any of that stuff that kind of sort of comes with that world of like setting intentions and affirmations. Like, to me, I think of that and I think of like people have crystals and I don't know, which is fine if that's your thing. But for me, it doesn't resonate with me to do that. But I really like setting intentions and having like personal affirmations, because I've struggled a lot over the past year with like my sense of self-worth and like self-criticism, which is so aggressive. Like, for anyone, when they have self-critical thoughts, it's aggressive. It just attacks you and it finds your weak spots. And I've found that you have to like be aggressively positive back just to neutralize it. And so like I will write down like things that I just need to hear about myself. Like, I'll do like 5 in a row, and then it's funny, like doing it, I'm like, God, I feel like such an idiot, like writing down like I am a brilliant songwriter. Something like, just something really stupid.
I love it.
But it's like, it's just crazy, because it's like, how did I even get to a point where I started like doubting myself, where I started having like issues with my self-worth? It's just, it's kind of scary, but it happens to everyone. So anyway, I try to be aggressive back, and I find that really helpful. And I do that when I'm journaling.
I love that. That's brilliant.
Yeah.
I mean, Michael's gonna, I can see you getting excited, because journaling is his baby. He loves journaling. And
yeah,
you know, and you're absolutely right. And I actually think I made a similar comment to you not long ago, Michael, in terms of journaling and it being a meditative state for you. Because I think we were having a conversation And you mentioned like, oh, actually, I haven't meditated in a while. I was like, yeah, but are you journaling every day? And you're like, yeah. It's like, well, there's, you know, you're present with your thoughts and feelings, and you're able to get in that zone. Yeah. Sorry, I'm talking. Michael, go.
No, that's all right, man. No, you're both 100% right. And Hannah, I think exactly what you said, that sort of like, I think there is this, in some cases, a stigma attached to like that just health and well-being, this sort of like self-motivational sort of stuff anyway, where it's like you need to be 100% in on every single aspect of it, and you need to make sure you do like 60 minutes in ice cold water every morning. Although Murph, we do love the cold water, don't we? But like, you know, like you can pick and choose the bits that suit you. And if you get from it what you need, then it's 100% it. Like, yeah. Then
totally.
Because I come in and out of all of these things so much. Like, I enjoy meditation, you know, but I very rarely practice it consistently. I might just sneak back into the morning every once in a while. But the journal is the one that has just been there, you know, for the last few years really consistently. And it's insane. And I love the fact to, like, I do like it because I do it online in like a Evernote, like a cloud thing.
Yeah.
And just to be able to like scroll back to like October 2018 and just read a day and just go, fuck.
Like, oh my God. Reading what back is never a good idea.
Oh, I love it. It's like, you know, like you can see growth or you can see regression. You can see all sorts of stuff. And, you know, I think it's hilarious. But no, it's such a cool thing. And I'm so glad you practice that. And is that, I guess, to bring that sort of the mental health journey forward into pandemic world, which, I mean, I have no doubt that all three of us are probably sick of talking about it to a certain extent, but it is something that it's obviously been so present to the whole planet, you know, in the last 18 months, 2 years. And for people like yourself, you know, in the entertainment industry, and I can imagine the last 18 months has been unlike any other, and I'm curious as to, like how you've, even more so in this time, how you've sort of managed to try and keep the balance as best as possible.
Yeah, not going to lie, it's been really tough for, that sounds so shallow. It's not that, how do I put it?
Before you put it, we feel like, and we qualify this all the time because we do it ourselves as well. It's like we always want to put this big asterisk in front of like any grievance that we have because we feel like we're, you know, you're grading on a curve and you've got to include everybody in the whole planet, which is and we know that there's people that are worse off, but like your pain is your pain. Like you can own it, and there's no like, it's, you know, it's nothing but humble, you know, it's, you know, there's no anything attached to it. So, yeah, I just have to say that because I'm saying that to myself as well. So,
no, I know. I think what I would say about the last 2 years is I've never even contemplated the thought of quitting music before I have now, which is weird and like scary and confronting and awful. And I know a lot of other people in this industry are thinking the same things because it's just like everything validating about the job, everything that makes it feel like it's a purposeful job and is giving something back to society has just kind of disappeared. And for me, I've just found that the job requirement has become very vain and not in line with how I view myself. Like over this pandemic, then the amount of times that like I've been pushed into doing TikTok or like just posting more online, or I'm just like, that's not what I'm about. Like I love connecting with people online, but to a point, like I really struggle online. I'm pretty scared of being online. And to be asked, I find it's almost like dance monkey. It's like, okay, go and do a TikTok. And it's like, but that's not what I'm good at. Like, that's not why people are interested in what I do. That's not why people buy tickets to my shows. So I found it really harrowing the way that the job has turned into such fickle things as like make a TikTok. And I'm just like, I can't do that. I actually can't keep it up. And then like you hear the sort of rhetoric that's like, oh, well, if you're not going to do that, then you have to adjust your expectations about your levels of success. And I'm like, what? Like, I don't want to be a part of this industry if this is what it is now. So anyway, I don't think I'll ever quit on music, but I've never wanted to quit like I have at the moment. And it's just, yeah, because it's just become this whole other beast that I'm just like, I don't have it in me to be posting on Instagram every day, posting TikToks. I'm like, it's just not who I am. And some people are really good at it. Like, and I wish I had that skill, but I just don't. So yeah, the whole pandemic has made me question a lot of things, which is, yeah, been really strange. And I've had a lot of moments where I haven't felt myself at all. But I don't know, you just have to hang on and it will end. And those good moments in the job will return. So that's what I just have to keep reminding myself about.
100%.
Yeah.
And just keep writing down that you're a really fucking good songwriter, you know, in the journal. Keep the affirmations going.
Oh, yeah.
No, it's totally understandable. And I think it's also something that it'll be a hard thing for a lot of people to completely empathize with, because majority of jobs don't hinge upon your public profile, I guess, you know. Yeah. What I mean, like, there's not a lot of, you know, like, we talk about this, we've spoken about this quite a lot with, you know, people in the sporting world, because for whatever reason, a lot of people in the public just have no line that they won't cross in criticizing, you know, people to their face online, whatever it is. Like, there's no filter, there's no like decorum when it comes to that stuff. And you know, it's kind of the boat you're in as well, with like being, if the demand of your career is right, you need to present yourself constantly and consistently so people remember and they want content, like, it's all about eyes on phones and stuff. Like, it's obviously not what's at the root of who you are and what you do. So yeah, I get the conflict.
Yeah. And it's just that being online has become such an unhealthy place for me. I mean, for a lot of people, but if I'm speaking about my personal experience, like, I used to like looking at comments. I used to like posting and sharing with my fans, blah, blah, blah. But I don't know. I noticed a shift earlier this year. I don't know if that's just what happens when you kind of maybe reach a certain level of success, when it's like the people that know you are outweighed by people that don't know you. So it starts to become like, yeah, you're just a faceless public figure that has no emotion. People can say whatever they want to you. And that really got to me. So I noticed I was getting a lot of like just really gross bro comments, like lad sexualized comments, which, you know what, whatever. I'm actually really happy to call that out. But then it turned into something even worse, which was like, I was getting shamed by both women and men. Not a lot, but there was enough of it for me to notice, for like being comfortable with expressing my sexual side or showing skin. And I just got this sort of rhetoric that was like, oh, you know, you don't have to do that to go mainstream. Or like, in my video clip for Complicated, I'm like literally just wearing like a crop top. And like, I got comments of people being like, why do you have to show so much flesh? It doesn't make me like the song anymore. And blah, 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 all this sort of stuff. And I was like, what? I'm like, why has it got anything to do with you, how I dress? Like, I just found it really And I called it out quite a lot, but then it took a toll. And I was like, you know what? I can't do this. So I just took a step away from social media and I don't look at comments very often. And I'm glad I did, I think, when you guys reached out, because, you know, it can lead to really positive things. But, yeah, a lot of the time I'm just like, huh, no, don't want to look.
I mean, that's a level of self-control that not a lot of people have, like, to be able to put yourself away from it. So, I mean, like, that's commendable in and of itself, really.
It's, interesting the point you raise. And I think, you know, part of the reason we wanted to come and, you know, launch the Women of Words podcast was to hear, I guess, the other side of the coin and things that affect their life, the people's lives that we're speaking to. And like coincidentally, timing wise, like I think yesterday or the day before, there was a big wipeout of Facebook and Instagram and WhatsApp. And one of the, I think it was actually on Triple J this morning that an ex-employee of Facebook came out like as a whistleblower and said, this lady said that, you know, there's targeted reasons that are putting at risk, putting young females at risk on social media platforms. And, you know, she's like, it's ridiculous. They know what they're doing and they know they can stop it, but they're not doing it because they're making their money.
Mm.
And, you know, like it is scary to think that they can control, you know. I'm getting a little bit off topic here, but it's sort of, it relates because, you know, it is something that's so accessible to so many people. And it's scary to think that, you know, one comment that say you might receive, and you've got the, I guess, experience to know that you can call them out and say, you know, piss off, that's ridiculous. But if that comment got to the wrong eyes of a 13-year-old girl per se, and she saw that, and, you know, that can go the complete opposite direction. It's really scary.
I know.
Yeah, wild.
Really scary. Wild.
At the same time, we are very grateful that you saw some comments too. So we're glad we could, cross paths. And absolutely. Absolutely. We're getting very close to the end, Hannah. I really appreciate all your time. And I think just on the, I guess, on the topic of COVID, and, you know, you're saying it was quite a rough couple of years personally, but I'm going out on a limb here to say that it's also been quite positive, because you just recently released the Reruns EP, and I'm guessing that, you know, that obviously being in the middle of COVID has been a bit of a silver lining on some of the work that you've had, some of the times you've been able to get through. I'd love to hear more about it. There's read a really interesting piece, which I think you were describing in your own words about Reruns, and sort of saying it was, you know, written in response to a bunch of frustrations from years prior, and, you know, work, I've got it here in front of me, relationships, work-life balances, social media traps, depression. And one thing that really stood out to me was trying to find the peace amongst all that chaos. I'd love to, dive into that a little bit if we could.
Yeah, of course.
Brilliant. Let's hear the journey, I guess, behind Reruns and, maybe some of the other stories as well,
Well, I didn't really know I was writing a body of work when I started this EP. I first wrote Complicated, and that was around the time that I first started figuring out stuff about my mental health, and it was a bit of an awakening. I'd come from such a different experience in my early 20s, living in London and like just being so high on life, like having the time of my life and not really having a care in the world really, and then to sort of fall into this slump in my mid-20s, it just kind of changed my artistry. It changed the way I wanted to write music, and the things I wanted to write about. So when I first wrote Complicated, I think it unlocked kind of a direction and sort of a theme that I felt like I wanted to explore more, which is kind of just like how confusing it is to be young at the moment in all sort of aspects, from like just living your life to what you do with your job to your relationships. And yeah, I just really wanted to sort of explore the small kind of nuanced feelings that I was feeling and just put them down into songs so that I could make sense of them. Like I think in Get Me So High, it has some of the most specific lyrics that I've ever written. Like I just noticed like I was feeling really needy, and like when someone wasn't replying to my text, I would go and like check online if they'd been online, and like I just honestly I felt like such a creep, and I was like, what am I doing? So anyway, I had to like explore that in a song, like just things like that, that, you know, I just guess hopes that other people would also relate to, because I know we all do it.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. But I mean, writing this EP, it started to take shape probably mid last year. I think I'd written most of the EP. Reruns was the last song I wrote. And I actually just love that song so much because it's happy, but it's sad, but it's kind of freeing. And I found writing it to be really easy, which I think a lot of the songs on the EP were easy to write, but for some reason that song just spilled out of my mouth. And I really like a lyric on that song, which is about like when you sort of ask your partner, like, oh, is that person attractive, just to see if they'll say yes, and almost just to give yourself a reason to hate yourself. I sort of explored that in that song as well. Yeah. I can't remember what your question was. Sorry, am I rambling?
No, absolutely not. No, it was, I love it. I was just sort of saying, yeah, talk us through the story. So
yeah.
Of how, you know, and it's really interesting to hear that it began at a similar time to when you started to really understand the struggles that you were facing on a deeper level. So, yeah. You know, it makes sense that it's, you know, you said it yourself, there's some really amazing lyrics and really pure storytelling in it. So it's a really, I really enjoy the EP.
I'm curious with like on the other side of song of writing about these things, obviously, you know, not necessarily that these things are equations to be solved and then they're done. Like I think obviously a lot of our personal growth is ongoing, but is there like, do you hit a point of like catharsis, or do you hit a point of like contentment, or, you know, just like a little bit of a better understanding on the other side of writing about this stuff? Like, is that part of how you are figuring out, you know, what's going on in the world?
Yeah, I think so. It takes a strange amount of time for me to process how I feel about a situation before I can write about it a lot of the time. Like a lot of the songs on this EP are about things that happened years ago. And maybe it's just funny how creativity works, because I didn't realize what I was writing. And then when I put together the EP, I was like, oh, I was like, that's what I was doing. Cause I just follow my intuition. I try not to think too hard about, is this the right song? Is that the right song? Blah, blah, blah. I'm just like feelings driven. And once it all came together, I was like, oh, okay. I see what I've done there. I've detailed this sort of reconciliation of my early 20s and this idea that like everything has consequences. Like I had the time of my life when I was 21, 22, 23. But it kind of all came back to bite me in the butt. So it was good to write these songs after the fact, and it kind of helped me make peace with a lot of the things I was feeling. It's interesting writing songs about a breakup once you're sort of feeling indifferent about it, which is what happened with quite a lot of the songs on the EP. Like they were like, yeah, just a lot of time had passed and it was me kind of more reflecting and having clarity, which I think helped me to write about the nuanced emotions, because I was like, oh, okay, that's what I was feeling there. Yeah.
That's it. Reflection. It's the, best tool in our toolkit. It's the best thing we got, right? It's
how we work. And now we can reflect on them for all time because they're they're in a song.
That's right. I am maybe just curious on one last thing, Hannah, and it's, you know, we, like Liam said, you know, we're so stoked to be, have made it to the point where we're opening up the conversation and, you know, being able to sort of kick off the women word side of things, because it is so important to get everyone's perspective on something, you know, as big an issue and as big a part of all of our lives as mental health. And so I'm just sort of curious about, like, I guess what your perspective of men's mental health is, I guess, you know, obviously being a female and being sort of on the outside looking into the men's mental health world.
Yeah. I mean, it's such a big question. And I've really enjoyed talking about mental health with you guys. It's not a conversation I have very often with men, which I think says something. And it's just interesting. It's definitely a generational thing. Like, I feel like our parents' age still hold on to this belief that men, you can't be men if you talk about your feelings. And it's just so perplexing to me, because as a woman in this day and age and a young woman, I'm like, nothing is more attractive to me than a man who can talk about how they feel. I'm just like, that's actually what I look for in a partner, in friendships. And everyone's different in the way they deal with things, but bottling things up is, I just don't think it's ever a good idea. And it should never signify how tough you are or if you're manly enough. And it makes me really sad that there are still men in our generation that hold on to that stigma. I find it really sad, because I know men that are struggling with things that I just wish that they could talk about it, because I know how much it would help them. But they're just not there yet. Which makes me really sad. But I don't know, I think the more people talk about it, and I think you're doing great work with this podcast, it definitely helps erase that stigma. So yeah, I don't know. That's just from the outside looking in. Yeah. It is sad. Like, women have been able to talk about their feelings forever. So
you're 100% right. And yeah, I appreciate that perspective, and appreciate the kind words. I mean, yeah, this is, you know, something that Liam and I, you know, doesn't pain us to say. We're incredibly proud of, you know, the conversations we get to have, and really, really grateful for them as well, of course. But yeah, I mean, you talk about that stigma and, you know, like, and even obviously so prevalent in the, you know, the our folks' generation to a certain, you know, pretty consistently, I imagine. But like, you know, I will can admit now, like, from a place of much better understanding, that, you know, I didn't feel dissimilarly to that, you know, not that long ago. Like, that was that was my understanding of it as well. So I think there is just this, like, residue from the old days of, like, how it used to be.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, and it's like, you know, it's kind of makes me a little embarrassed to, like, admit it, but it is kind of how it is. And obviously, you know, Murph, like we said, you know, we're super proud of how much we've been able to grow through this. But you're right, like, it makes exactly your answer just makes me think of, like, the amount of people, whether it mum, you know, relatives, friends that were females that must have seen, like, my attitude towards that sort of stuff, or must have seen me struggling and bottling it all up and wishing that they could, you know, lead the horse to water and get it to drink as well.
Honestly, like, I've had conversations with people of that generation before where I've been, like, upset that, like, in the past when a relationship of mine wasn't going very well, and I'd be like, I just, he won't tell me anything that he's feeling. And the response I've gotten back has been, you can't push men to talk about their feelings. They don't want to talk about their feelings, as if that's okay. Just, yeah. And I'm like, what? Yeah. I'm like, no. Like, I almost felt like a kid just being like, no, like that can't be the way it is. Like, it's not fair for anybody involved. It's like, it's not fair for men, not fair for women. It's just, yeah, it's, I think it's definitely taking steps in a positive direction, but it feels like there's a lot of work to do still. And sometimes I feel like I'm in a bit of an echo chamber with the people around me, and I'm like, yeah, I'm around a lot of sensitive men, but that's just a very small, like, sample of society. And I know there's just that stigma is rife in a lot of parts of Australia. But yeah, no, I commend you guys. It's really cool. And it's been a very good conversation too. I've been mentally stimulated.
That's nice. A positive.
Oh, we appreciate it. And I think, look, your message is probably a nice place to leave it, I guess, Murph. I'm sure you're probably thinking the same thing, like that, you know, just the want and wish for, you know, the ladies in our life that want fellas to be better at talking about this stuff is, I mean, we're 3 from 3 for the conversations we've had so far on the Women of Words, and I can't imagine that's going to change. You know, I think you're probably speaking for most of the planet that would benefit from fellas talking about their shit a little bit more.
Hannah, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for thank you for coming on, and appreciate the time that you've given us. And sorry, we might have run a little bit longer than anticipated, but you know, when we're having these conversations, it's hard to press stop sometimes, because it's
that's okay.
Really,
that's
really right. Beautiful and really enjoyable conversation. So really, really grateful, really thankful, and hopefully we get to a show and see you do your thing in the not too distant future here in Australia. And we really look forward to hopefully crossing paths and being able to thank you in person for a beautiful conversation.
Well, thank you so much for having me.